We are on different continents today.
I know, it's tragic. You're too far away. Come back.
Do you actually feel close to me when I'm in Paris and you're in Amsterdam?
Doesn't really bother me, actually, to be honest.
That's fine. I might just stay here. And actually, I'm kind of tempted not to come back because I have been having a great time. I'm in South Africa after 4 days in Kenya, and I've just been hanging out with great people and going dancing and having a great time.
Yeah, that really doesn't sound like a work trip.
I have also been like training some new colleagues, but you know, it's kind of a side note.
Does training mean going out and dancing?
Yes. Been training and dancing at the same time. Multitasking.
It sure is. I mean, sometimes my job is dancing in a show. So dancing can be work.
As a journalist, not so much. It's harder to make that argument. But anyway, what have you been up to?
I'm in London now. I had a friend's wedding yesterday, which was very nice. Although I'd kind of braced myself for everyone to be talking about the election for some reason, because I just arrived in the UK a few days before a general election. It's filling my Twitter feed and no one mentioned it at all, which maybe is a good thing at a wedding.
If I was getting married this week, the last thing I would want is to walk around on the happiest day of my life and just hear everyone talking about Boris Johnson.
Yeah, good point. But we're not talking about Boris Johnson this week. We are heading to Malta, which is a country that's in the midst of a pretty enormous political crisis, which has been going on since October 2017, when there was the atrocious assassination of the country's leading investigative journalist, Daphne Caruana Galizia. We're going to be speaking to Ranier Fsadny, who is a columnist for The Times of Malta and The Shift, and I say we, but actually it's just me, because Katie was busy dancing in South Africa.
Working.
So it's just me speaking to Ranier later on in the show.
Let's move on swiftly. Before the interview, let's have Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Who's had a bad week, Katie?
Well, runner-up for bad week goes to my usual country of residence, France, which is in the grip, again, of mass strikes, doing what we do best. But I'm going to give bad week this week to the migrants who were defrauded in quite a weird and horrible scam that was uncovered in Russia recently. I don't even know where to start with the story. It sounds almost fictional. But basically what happened is that this con artist built a fake border post near Russia's border with Finland and told these migrants that if they paid him about 10,000 euros each, then he would smuggle them across this border into Finland and therefore into the European Union. Except it wasn't a border. The whole thing was fake. This guy put up fences and fake signs, and he drove these four migrants around in a car for ages and marched them through the woods. When all the time they were still in Russia, in Vyborg. They were near the border with Finland, but not, you know, actually on it. It was quite an audacious plan to take advantage of some really desperate people. And while it was an incredibly shitty thing to do, you'll be glad to hear that the con man behind the scam has been arrested. They actually got stopped by the authorities while he was leading them on this wild goose chase, which is how the whole thing came out. We don't really know that much about him or about the victims, apart from that the migrants were from somewhere in South Asia and a Russian court has since ordered them to be deported. So it doesn't have a good ending for them either.
God, that's awful.
Yeah, it's really shitty. And aside from mildly destroying my faith in humanity this week, this story is a bit of a reminder that people do sometimes try to get into the European Union through the land border that we have with Russia and other former Soviet countries. It's quite difficult to find numbers, but in recent years, border forces have only detected about 1,500 people crossing a year, which is really small compared to the Mediterranean, which is obviously tens of thousands of people attempting that really dangerous boat crossing every year. Can I be really angry for a minute?
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
You don't need my permission.
I just wanted to say that I think it's really easy for those of us who have nice, comfortable lives to forget just how grim the situation is for migrants in Europe right now, especially because it isn't generating the headlines that it used to. But in places like Lesbos in Greece and Vučjak in Bosnia, thousands of people are going to be spending this winter in filthy camps in the freezing cold. And it is shameful, frankly, that it's allowed to go on like this. We should all collectively be ashamed. First, that it's happening, and secondly, that we're not really talking about it. I mean, there are lots of good organisations out there helping people on the ground, so you can always donate to them. But if you're angry about this, then I thoroughly encourage people to write to their MEPs and say so. if it matters to you, then the people that represent you should, yeah, they should hear about it.
And how do you write to your MEP, Katie?
I think you can just Google it, Dominic.
Yeah, actually, didn't we discover that you can also find their phone numbers?
Yeah, I think you can just ring them and like email them. And I think they have to reply, right?
Write to your MEP. Sorry, I'm just looking it up. Yeah, they will respond to letters and emails, and you can even arrange to meet them.
Brilliant. So I will be doing that. And you should too, about anything that's on your mind.
I will. I'm afraid Good Week is a bit flippant compared to your bad week, but I guess sometimes we have to talk about more flippant things. And actually, it's not flippant for the person at the centre of the case who has had a good week. His name is Tal R, and he's an Israeli artist based in Denmark. And he's had a good week because he won an injunction against a pair of Faroese designers who had bought one of his pieces of artwork and were planning on cutting it up into teeny tiny pieces and putting the little fragments into watches for their high-end watch company.
Love it.
Do you? Yeah, I think it's a pretty strange idea, personally. But it was a complicated copyright case because the pair of watch designers were claiming that they were not altering the work, but they were destroying it, something which is allowed under Danish law.
Hang on. You're saying that they're not allowed to alter it, but they are allowed to destroy it?
Yeah.
That seems like the wrong way around to me.
Yeah.
Why should you be allowed to destroy bits of art but not alter them?
Well, because if you own it, then you can destroy. It is controversial, and it's not the case in many other countries. I know in lots of countries that the artist retains the copyright of their artwork, even if someone else owns the actual physical thing. So they wouldn't be able to destroy it. But yeah, it is a complicated one. But something is clear in Danish law, and that is that alteration is a big legal no-no. And the court ruled that they viewed it as alteration. And it seemed to turn on the fact that the watch company were going to explicitly market the watches using the artist's name, Tal R, which is pretty cheeky, really. The painting they were using was one of his sex shop series, and they'd bought it in London for £70,000. And they'd also bought up some other work from Danish artists to put in other watches. It looks like they won't be able to go ahead with that for now. They were forced to pay just over €4,000 in legal fees. So bad week for those two provocative watchmakers, and good week for Tal R and his painting, which is saved but presumably still in the hands of those watch people, who I'm just calling watch people. Maybe they're going to cut it up anyway in revenge, just like to destroy it. I hope not.
Can I express what's possibly going to be an unpopular opinion?
What, you're going to say you think they should be allowed to do it?
Yeah, well, specifically for this painting, I don't like it. And I think maybe it would have looked better as watch straps.
Katie, you Philistine, art is not there to be liked necessarily. Art can be provocative. And if we allow people to just financially benefit off other people's art, then that will be a really, really sad moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do agree that buying this guy's painting and cutting it up without his permission, rude. But also, he was trying to make this argument that all of this was going to damage his reputation. And I'm not really sure that it would have done. Like, he's got loads of publicity out of all of this.
I think it would have damaged his reputation, because being an artist who decides to put your art in watches is like a very specific kind of commercialized art. And I don't think he's that kind of artist. So yeah, I actually have very little sympathy for the watchy people. I think it was a stupid money-making scheme, and it was exploitative, and yeah, tough. They have to decide what they're going to do next, because they could actually appeal the ruling. It's only an injunction, so they might have to go to a full trial.
Ooh.
So we'll see. But weirdly, the watchy people claimed it wasn't a commercial project. And according to The Guardian, they said, it's not a commercial project, but we don't know if it's an artistic project. That has to be determined by others.
So what is it? It's a project.
Yeah.
A watchy project.
Maybe it's a labour of love like our podcast, Katie.
Maybe it is. But our podcast is also a work of art. Like, what would you do if people took our Europeans podcast tote bags and cut them up and turn them into watch straps?
I'd actually say in that case it was totally fine.
I think that's actually probably the best thing for them.
We need all the publicity we can get.
So I have to confess, Dominic, that with all the work I've been doing, in inverted commas, while I've been away this week, I haven't had that much time to catch up with the latest developments in Malta. apart from knowing that they've been pretty crazy. So I'm really glad that you've done an interview this week that's going to help me understand the whole thing.
Yeah, it's quite a complicated story. And I'm actually glad I did this interview as well, because whilst I've been like vaguely following it, there have been so many twists and turns that it's quite difficult to keep on top of it. And yeah, the case has had some pretty enormous ramifications. Last week, the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff resigned due to allegations that he'd been interfering in the murder investigation. Subsequently, the Prime Minister himself announced that he would be stepping down in January, but protesters in Malta think that is not soon enough. So to help us unpack what's happening in this rather horribly complicated web of politics, organised crime and investigative journalism, we have Ranieh Vsadny on the line. We started by remembering the work of the murdered journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia.
She had a very long career, over 30 years, and she innovated on a number of levels. She was the first columnist to be critical of the political party then in government that she was assumed to be in sympathy with. The critical tone that she had was considered extraordinary at the time. Nowadays, if you go back and look at what she wrote, what would strike you is that the tone she adopted then is now mainstream among columnists in Malta. So that was one of the first important things. A qualitative leap came when she began her blog in 2008. She was extraordinary in the sheer traffic she had. I mean, the numbers would be the envy of a political blogger in the United States. And I'm not talking about proportional numbers. I'm just talking in terms of sheer numbers. For many people, the blog was the first thing they checked, even if they actually loathed her. And then the blog itself, up until her death, she was arguably the only independent financial journalist. She was independent of the industry, and she could explain it all in very simple language. And finally, the sheer network of information sources that she had, which she used to call humorously her international worldwide network of spies, would I think be the envy of any news organization.
So she was a pretty formidable force in Malta by the sounds of things, and had quite a lot of powerful people as enemies. Is it clear yet which of these enemies are the people who ordered her murder?
Well, the matter is before the courts. But the man who has been brought before the court as a mastermind, and the pattern that is emerging, suggests that at the heart of this is the project to introduce a power station in Malta by the current government. It was its flagship promise in the 2013 election. There were many warning signs that something was not right, from the plan itself to what emerged later with respect to the financing, etc. She had a massive leak given to her, massive in the sense of a volume of documents coming from this consortium. So it does seem to be there that the police are looking at, and this would therefore implicate not only the businessman who is in court right now, but given that it has been discovered that he had a secret company based in the Gulf committed to pay 5,000 euros each per day, one to a Panama company owned by the former chief of staff of the current prime minister, and the closest minister to the prime minister. He has since resigned from cabinet, but only recently. Well, that suggests that it was a web of people in government and in business.
How do you think we should deal with the political implications whilst this criminal case is still ongoing? If nothing's been proven yet criminally, no one's been found guilty, what do you think should be done in the meantime?
Well, no one has been found guilty, but there have been plenty of leaks and declarations that suggests that, at the very least, the former chief of staff should be investigated actively by the police, that the prime minister himself should be investigated. There have been so many details that have emerged over the past week in the testimony given by the so-called middlemen who arranged for the assassination, that it is not hyperbole to say that the police ought to treat the office of the prime minister as a crime scene and search it thoroughly.
Why do you think the prime minister is clinging on to power for another 5 weeks? Surely it would be in the interest of everyone, I mean, the country, the family of Caruana Galizia, even the party itself, for him to resign immediately.
That's what everyone knows, and it's the million-dollar question, because it is so obvious that it is in the interests of the party and the country that he should resign. People obviously have the worst suspicions that he may not just be trying to make sure that the facts emerge, but to control which facts emerge. That is something we still have to see, but it is his behavior over the last couple of weeks is a scandal in itself and disqualifies him in itself. This is apart from the fact that for the last 3 years, he has known that his then chief of staff and the closest minister had secret Panama companies set up in the first few days after winning power. And not only did he do nothing about it, he defended them.
One of the most shocking stories that's come out these last few weeks has been this example when journalists were locked in a room following a press conference of the prime minister. Could you tell our listeners what happened there and how it's been explained by the prime minister's office?
Well, the prime minister gave a conference to national and international journalists following a six-hour cabinet meeting that ended at 3 a.m. And his point was, apparently, to assure everyone that Malta did have rule of law. Whereupon, he left the room, followed by his cabinet ministers, and broke the law by locking the journalists in the room under the eye of hired thugs. Now, I'm saying thugs because these people were not police. They were not members of official security forces. Those of them who have been identified have been revealed to be Labour Party stalwarts, some of them even out on bail. This was illegal detention by any standard, including Maltese laws. It's lasted for 20 minutes. That only means that the law was broken for a very short while, not that the law wasn't broken. So the prime minister, who says that no one is above the law, openly broke the law before international journalists. And the question arises, if he is ready to break the law over a relatively minor matter to avoid answering questions, he only took four at that conference, and if he is prepared to do it so openly, what is he prepared to do behind the scenes over bigger matters? I should say, for the purposes of completion, that the Attorney General's office has given an explanation because a judicial protest has been filed in court. The Prime Minister's office has not explained, has not apologized. But the Office of the Attorney General has said, no, this was protocol. Anytime you visit a place, there has to be an order of exit to ensure order and lack of crowding. So apparently the thugs are part of the official protocol and hospitality.
It sounds like a really strange move, a really strange show of strength. And it makes me question, is there something rotten in the political system in Malta? And does the Prime Minister have too much power constitutionally? Is that what's going on?
If we were writing the Constitution today, we wouldn't concentrate so many powers effectively in the hands of the Prime Minister. In practice, the Prime Minister ends up being an executive president, but in a parliamentary system that assumes he is not an executive president. So I would agree, the Constitution needs to be revised, but we should not let that distract us from the fact that between 1964 and just a few years ago, this contradiction was managed reasonably well. There were worse periods and there were better periods. We are not here because of the Constitution. We are here because of someone who abused the Constitution.
I imagine you've been fearing for your country over the last years while this has been going on, but has there been any sense of optimism, seeing how the public have been rising up in protest against this scandal?
Yes. 2 weeks ago, I would not have imagined that so many people would be out in the streets protesting peacefully, but vociferously and ferociously against a prime minister who seemed all-powerful. We still have a very difficult road ahead. But 2 weeks ago, it seemed impossible.
A special thanks to Margarita Poulet, who's one of our listeners in Malta, who suggested Ranier as a guest. Thank you so much for this suggestion and for encouraging us to talk about Malta. We love receiving emails with ideas of people to talk to or things to talk about. Send us an email, hello@europeanspodcast.com.
Not for the first time this episode, I'm just appalled at the kind of things that have been going on European soil. But like you say, it's great that people in Malta aren't letting this stand and have been taking to the streets in such big numbers to say that they won't stand for it. Nevertheless, I think I could still do with a happy ending.
Okay. We're in Rome for this week's happy ending, and this is actually a happy one for once.
Okay.
I think.
Shouldn't they be always?
Yeah, it's a confused. Maybe I should rename it the kind of like ambiguously happy ending, but maybe that's life. So they were doing some work a few years ago on the Metro C line in Rome, and they stumbled across the foundations for a portico of what they believe to be a lavish Roman villa from the 2nd century, just sitting below the city all this time.
Wow.
Do you know what a portico is, Katie?
Like a sort of door thing?
Yeah, well done. It's kind of a posh word for porch. Yeah.
It's because I'm so posh.
I actually had to Google it to check. But the mere discovery of this portico isn't the extraordinary thing. The extraordinary thing is that they've just released some intensive research into the oak timbers in the structure that is in the foundations of this portico. And they've discovered that the wood was cut from trees in France over 1,000 miles away from Rome. Now, this is a 2nd century villa, and they managed to move oak timbers 1,000 miles. The wood comes from the Jura Mountains in eastern France, to be more specific. And I'm not here to celebrate the chopping of any tree.
Tree hater.
But when I read this, I just like marveled at the fact that the Romans had their shit together to transport trees over 1,000 miles. Researchers think that the wood was probably transported by river and by sea. They can narrow down the dates that the trees were felled to between 40 and 60 AD, which I also think is quite amazingly specific. How do researchers do these things?
You're so amazed by everything today.
I am. It's a tree story. Trees are amazing. The Romans were so advanced. And modern day archaeologists are also pretty incredibly clever. So happy ending.
We have several new Patreon supporters to thank this week. Very generous people who are helping to keep this show running. Philip Cox, Owen Atkinson, Cassandra Hartman, and Tom Moylan, who has not only signed up to help support the show, but was actually in it last week. You might recognise his name. He's the speechwriter who gave us that very unorthodox tour of the European Commission last week. So thank you all very much. For those of you who haven't heard last week's episode, please go back and listen. It's a great one. And it's the kind of thing that we're starting to be able to do thanks to support from our lovely Patreon members. So it's super exciting.
If you would like to follow us on social media, then please do. We are on Twitter, occasionally tweeting at Europeans Pod. We are on Instagram, Europeans Podcast. And you can find us on Facebook, The Europeans Podcast. I think.
Facebook.
We will be back next week with a story from Hungary. Please tune in.
What was that?
I don't know why I said that in a weird voice. Bye, guys.
Thanks for listening.